Right.
This is At the Races with Steve Beck.
From Tucson, Arizona, Lowe's Ventana Canyon Resort, the University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program Symposium on Racing. And happy to be back here in Tucson, what has become really I was about to call it a rite of spring, but that's baseball. A rite of early winter. How about that? Or late fall, something like that. Happy to be back here, and of course, the conference itself, the symposium, really doesn't get underway until later this afternoon, but registrants will come wandering in the trade show portion, pretty much close to set up, and over the next 3 days, we'll get a parade of industry participants, and most notably, as we welcome in racetrack industry program alumnus, proud Wildcat himself, Rick Hammerly, and of course the students. They're the key to all of this. It's the reason we come. They put the whole thing on. It's so important to them, and always one of the highlights of the broadcast season, the University of Arizona students. Hammer, good morning.
Good morning from foggy Tucson.
What's with this?
I don't know. I don't remember, and the security guard this morning, she went outside and she said, I've lived here 30 years, I've never seen anything like it. So, foggy, and I said something to you, you won't hear too often, let me get my jacket. Because they have the door open behind us here. But it's, yeah, we had some rain. I had a rare double yesterday. I left L.A. in the rain and I landed here in the rain.
Well, you left from a new airport somewhere. They built another airport in Inglewood?
I don't even tell you, it's the craziest thing.
That picture was unbelievable you put up yesterday.
I take the flyaway, the bus from close to my house, and it's easier for the old drive to the airport if we're going to L.A., so just like a 10-minute drive, Gina drops me off, and I'll take the bus down there. I landed at 4 in the morning. I was like 8 o'clock. I got out of the darn bus. There was five cars at the whole airport.
Very strange.
It was unbelievable. I've never seen it that way. I mean, I've tried to plan my trips when it's, you know, not as crowded, like Sunday mornings, but at wintertime, around the holidays and all that stuff. But anyway, so yes, and then come here and it's the same thing. But I was wondering what number this was. I didn't see it on the agenda. What conference? Got to be close to 50.
Wow.
Right?
Wow. Is that right?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, I went here 30-some years ago, 35 years ago, and it was going on before then. So, I mean, I got to think it's close to 50.
How about that? I was gonna ask you, because there'll be any number of alumnus that are featured here. In fact, you know, right in the middle, there's RTN, Dan Silver, of course. I see that Pete Aiello is speaking or moderating the Dave Johnson, Tom Durkin conversation that's always featured. All kinds of alum. Todd Pletcher will join us tomorrow. He's actually getting on a plane himself, heading to Florida this morning, and said, how about tomorrow? Because we want Todd to talk about his time here as well at the University of Arizona. So the alumnus side of it and the current students, most importantly, Rick, every year we put on the fresh voices, the fresh faces that are hoping to, not just hoping, they're expecting to and most certainly will carve out careers in the industry.
Well, you mentioned the students, and as a former student here, I can tell you, the students put the show on here.
Yeah.
I mean, they get everything organized and contact the sponsors and all that stuff. And it's not one of those, it's a labor of love because I tell you, I don't know how a lot of other industries work, but this is where literally from looking at the list of when people are coming in from around the country and going to literally pick them up at the airport, having that nice little half-hour ride up here where you get to know them, and then spending two or three days with industry people, insiders, where you literally can just walk up to and say, hey, how you doing? My name's Jimmy. I'd like to sit down with you for a while. And that's known. The guests that come here, the attendees know that that's part of the program. When the students are here, they're here to talk to you. And it's a great interaction. And I know it helped me, you know, meet, you know, 10 people all of a sudden. And then when you see them in a year or two out in the industry, they go, hey, I remember you from the school. So unique to this industry and the way it gets to perform here. But the students are the show. And put it this way, what other sport can you go to college to get a degree in and just really move right into the game?
And by the way, just looked up at the agenda on the University of Arizona website, rtip.arizona.edu, 48th symposium.
So we're pretty close.
Yeah, 40. It's amazing. It's amazing. And we, you know, over the years, we've talked about the origins and the, you know, the growth, and it started with just a handful of students, and then, you know, the university, I guess, saw the benefit and saw the potential, works in under the ag science division, and the options, we'll certainly get into that, because the students that'll visit with us, they come here with different plans. Essentially, there's plenty that come with an idea of working with the animals and then end up in an entirely different arena. And they realize, and then the other way around, those that, get intrigued by, you know, by the animals, and so many, you know, so many friends and even people I met, Rick, before, you know, we started coming out here, and even before it was frankly, got involved on the show, our friend Lori Fry, my partner, Barry Fry's niece, she was here, and her intention originally was to work with animals, and she ends up in the equine insurance end of the game. So it's amazing. Dan Silver, I mean, Dan wanted to be on the racetrack management side, and it had a fascinating, you know, circuitous path through NYRA and Penn Gaming before signing on at RTN as one of their top executives. So it's just it's fluid, and one of the beauties of the game is that there's so many disciplines for people to potentially, you know, venture toward.
Well, what happens here, and one of the huge benefits of the program is the internships that are offered by wagering companies, racetracks, marketing. And when you go to a racetrack as an intern from here, you go to all the departments. And so, like you mentioned, you might go in into the marketing department and then spend time in the racing office and go, wow, this is what I want to do. Or, you know, in the accounting office and say, oh, I'd like to do that. So it exposes you to so many facets of the industry that you don't get, out of the book, so to speak. And I knew where I was going. Regardless, and a lot of people do, but like you said, all of a sudden you get there and you go, I'm going to go left instead of right, but it's still on the racetrack. So anyway, great spot, great place to be, and I don't know, in Tucson, Arizona in the wintertime, it was a great place to go to school, can I tell you?
You've indicated some of the fun, and of course the running mates that you continue, you know, all the whole, your whole career that you've stayed in close contact with and have stayed friendly with and have worked with, and that's true of every generation of racetrack industry program alumnus. Pretty amazing. So we'll get a ton of the program elements, and then also the specifics and the opportunity for the agenda and for what will be discussed here. And obviously, the backdrop that has dominated all discussion and all industry debate and discussion, the situation involving HISA, and that will be front and center here over the next 2.5 days. The news over the weekend, of course, there were two things, essentially, as the week was ending. First was the acknowledgement that the second court date was approaching, and that is Wednesday for the Sixth Circuit. And every indication had been that depending on what happened in the Sixth Circuit would determine next steps toward the constitutionality part of HISA. If the Sixth Circuit agreed that with the Fifth that the elements were unconstitutional, it would pretty much preclude that HISA would need to be reworked. And then the option that they, the other option that they don't find that they disagree with the Fifth Circuit, that would potentially set up a Supreme Court rendering. However, in the interim, over the weekend, story emerged out of Washington of Mitch McConnell, who has obviously been drawn in to discussions. And McConnell is working to create a legislative remedy for the portions of the Fifth Circuit decision that called and considered HISA unconstitutional. And if that were to happen, then it won't really matter what happens in the court, because they can address this successfully in Congress potentially, and it has the same trappings, this fix has the same trappings that the passing of HISA did originally, which is it'll be like a pilot fish, attach itself to an omnibus bill, a spending bill, at the end of the year, so it won't provide for any opportunity for anyone to oppose or ask for further evaluation. So that is in the works, apparently, and the way in which the Reuters story handled it, citing unnamed sources or sources that preferred to remain anonymous, that's always encouraging. You can tell that the potential to have this done, the way the HISA proponents want it done, is there in place. So I'm sure there'll be further conversation. We'll bring the other legal people forward here as well to get to explain what is involved and how it is likely to unfold. But the HISA team is basically being quoted as saying they expect clear sailing.
Well, this hotel is teeming with racing commissioners, and the ARCI has two meetings, I think, today on whether it's related to that or not. I know they have their model rules meeting, and then that I was a couple of them from various states at the bar early in the evening discussing stuff. So you know how all courts are. They would rather have stuff done beforehand and not get to the court. So if that's the way it's going to be, it's the way it's going to be. I'm moderating a racing secretary's summit panel, and we are discussing various things. And actually, we have decided we are moving on as if HISA is going to continue, which we have to. We're talking about implementation of rules and things like that, and so we have to go along with that right there as far as that goes. But HISA will do what HISA does, and we'll, like you said, probably this week we'll have a couple of those lawmakers on, and we'll see what they have to say. But moving on, I gotta say, I'm gonna really skip here for a second.
Yeah.
We have complaints in our game, as of course we do of our stewards. Every once in a while on a bad call here or there, but I gotta tell you, If you watch some football this weekend, college football, and then the pros yesterday.
I didn't watch any college.
There were some calls that are just that just blew my mind. I mean, I'll jump off the couch type of calls, and I on mostly games that I didn't have wagers on. But I mean, college football, the officiating has got a lot to be desired. From spotting the ball to this, and they actually have replay in college football. It's a different convoluted type of deal. And anyone who watched that TCU game at the end of the game there has to just be shaking their head no matter what. There's one play where they're at the end of the game in overtime when they're down by the goal line, and the quarterback, I can't remember his name for TCU, he lunges, comes up a few inches short. They place the ball at the one-yard line. They replay it. It shows he's a few inches short, and they don't move the ball. The next play, they dive over the top. They got the overhead view. Looks like he crosses the line. They don't even review it. Yesterday in some of the pro games, now granted I was involved in a couple of those, but just call after call, just horrendous. Why do you have a replay if you're not going to make the right call?
You got to tie it to the steward scenario. This is one of the great mysteries. I mean, the technology has come a long, long way, and yet there's still unsatisfying conclusions and calls or non-calls, whether it's pro sports or whether it's racing. It's very, very difficult to understand.
I don't get it. In football, how can I and my buddy sitting on the couch make the call in one replay and they take 10 minutes? I've come to the conclusion that the NFL needs to appoint one fan every week that can throw the red flag, make the phone call.
Like the commercial.
Make the phone call.
Like those great commercials.
I mean, it's just ridiculous. There's another reason that I don't make my living betting on pro football. I mean, it would drive me crazy. I'm actually starting to watch it again. I took a couple of years off after all the stuff, and it was very unnerving to just look at the final score. I mean, it was still making a bet, but I would just get up the next day and watch look at the score. And now I'm getting back into watching it, and it's kind of, it's aggravating. But anyway, don't feel so bad. I mean, when you get a bad call or two in racing.
Well, the good news for our listeners from Dave Hill's action this weekend, 9-5 going into tonight. He likes Tampa tonight, but 4-2 for our listeners, the six games that he tabbed, and actually Tampa would be the seventh. Dave is now, just for our listeners, 44-36-2 since the National Football League came up.
Good for Dave.
No, Dave's been great. And now actually, what was he? He was 10 games over 500 going into this week. So he is now starting to really build a nice cushion. Another four games. So he's 14 games over 500. And believe me, there's plenty of games that he has to pick because the New York Times told him pick every game, and there's plenty of games he'd lay off. But he gives us the prime. So he and I were texting back and forth all weekend actually as I was traveling. Got here Saturday and I thought I was arriving here at 4 o'clock at Phoenix, and I ended up I got here much later, and I must have misinterpreted my flight schedule, and so I didn't get to Phoenix till like 8:30, and then it was pouring. The drive down 5 was no bargain to Tucson on Saturday night. Because there was standing water, and five takes you to what?
Five's in California.
Was it 10? What is it? Anyway, I thought it was a single digit road, but whatever.
Maybe.
But it was and plus it was dark like pitch dark. It was not a and as Tina chides me, I am from a visual standpoint, I'm not what I used to be eyesight wise.
Tucson's a designated dark town, if you want to call it that, for the observatory.
Oh, really?
If you drive here at night, you'll notice there's not a lot of street lights around.
Interesting.
It's very dark. It's on purpose so that city lights don't interfere with the observatories up here. Mount Kitt has a big observatory. Yeah, like a big like a world-class observatory up there, so they keep the city dark.
Interesting.
Darker than normal.
Wow.
So, as you're driving around at night, you'll notice, you know, of course, where the you know, the businesses are, they have their little things, but in, like out here, up in the foothills.
Interesting.
It is D-A-R-K dark.
Wow.
Pretty wild.
I didn't know about the observatory. I there have certainly been nights where I've gone out and the sky is amazing here. That and maybe that's one of the reasons, because there's not as much ambient glow from the city.
Kitt Peak National Observatory. There it is.
Kitt Peak.
Kitt Peak. They do a lot of, or they did a lot of work up there. You know.
Let's catch up on a little bit of the weekend action. And, of course, Del Mar wrapped up yesterday. You had the two terrific Grade 1 opportunities. One of the great stories from the weekend, undoubtedly, the final career starts for two really, really nice horses, both 6 years old. Regal Glory, bred and campaigned early on by our late friend Paul Pompa. We've been a huge fan. She closes out her career yesterday with another win in the Matriarch, and I'll go over some of her amazing career stats in a second. And on Saturday, it was Mind Control that achieved the same fond farewell. And we'll talk, obviously, to Todd Pletcher tomorrow about Mind Control. And, of course, he and Greg Sacco combining for the Brunetti family to campaign Mind Control to a career. 29 starts, 12 wins, 3 seconds, 6 thirds. And notably, because both of these horses are borderline, especially in light of the crime dog, Fred McGriff, getting Hall of Fame status yesterday, they're both borderline Hall of Fame types. I mean, they probably both are just shy of the credentials, but we'll start with Mind Control, Rick. Here's a few of the notable elements of his career with those 12 wins and 29 starts. He won a graded stake every year of his career, including three Grade Ones. The Hopeful as a 2-year-old, the Jerkins as a 3-year-old, Cigar Mile as a 6-year-old, the three Grade Ones. At 4, he won the Grade 3 Tom Fool. At 5, he won the Grade 2 John Nayrud. 9 stake wins, 7 graded stake wins, 3 Grade Ones, a Grade 2, and 3 Grade 3s. Mind Control. And that you know, winning a graded stake at every age that you compete is a sign of obviously durability and, you know, just consistency. When it came to Regal Glory, 23 starts, 13 wins, 6 seconds, no thirds, 11 stake wins, 4 Grade Ones, including 3 this year, plus 3 Grade One placings. And she very well may have swung the vote in her favor as the filly and mare turf champion this year with this third Grade One. How about this for an oddity? I won't call it an oddity, a distinction. She competed, Rick, at 8 different racetracks in her career. You got the PPs in front of you? I got the notes. The PPs are in the stack. She competed at Del Mar, Belmont, Keeneland, Kentucky Downs, Gulfstream, Saratoga, Aqueduct, and Penn National. She won a stake every single racetrack at which she competed. And I don't know how often, when you talk about 8 venues, you can say that.
That's pretty incredible.
It's unbelievable, actually, and it just sort of popped into my purview here just as I was making notes. She won the 2 Matriarchs, the Just a Game, the Wiley, the Ladies at Kentucky Downs, the Pegasus Ladies Turf at Gulfstream, obviously, the Lake George and the Lake Placid as a 3-year-old at Saratoga, the Plenty of Grace at Aqueduct, and the Penn Oaks when she visited Penn National. So obviously, one start at Penn National, one start at Kentucky Downs, and she wins both of those races. You know, the trips to Del Mar, and it's a very, very impressive career. And of course, Peter Brandt bought her at the dispersal after Paul's passing, and you know, so Jad got to maintain the helm essentially on Regal Glory, and she, you know, she leaves as, I suppose, Animal Kingdom's top performer, I'm going to guess.
Well, I know when I look at horses, and, you know, I vote, I don't vote for the Hall of Fame, but I do vote at the end of the year. That move, that's a big move up for me when I see horses travel and do well traveling. I mean, instead of staying on the old home circuit. So, then what about Mind Control? I bet he's raced at 8, 9 different racetracks. I mean, I think when you think of a horse over the past 3, 4 years that, gosh, you wouldn't mind having in your barn, that one always comes to mind. I mean, let's talk about Greg Sacco, who his family's been close to the Brunettis for years, who started Mind Control and kind of got a nice base into him. I mean, he started at Delaware. His first five starts were at 5 different racetracks. Mind Control. So, and then they zeroed in with him on what his specialty was, 7 furlongs a mile type of thing, and they didn't go outside of that box too often. And they just pounded and pounded and pounded, and boy, he just, I don't know if he said if he had a style. I think earlier in his career, without thinking, I think he came from more off the pace, if I'm not mistaken. I could be wrong there. But he just kind of, you look up at the eighth pole, who's that? Oh, it's Mind Control again. And the same thing the other day. He pulled off he barely got respect at the windows as well, as the other day wasn't the favorite. So, you know, they handed the baton off to Todd, and he just kept on going. You know, it's like, don't mess it up. We got a good thing going here. And he didn't. So it's nice to see horses like that race later into their careers, and that's what we need. That's what the game needs. Let them run.
You know, notably, let's see, $2.2 million, just under $2.2 million in earnings, and he's got to be Stay Thirsty's top earner, or I would think, right? Who else? There is somebody else I'm not thinking of on the Stay Thirsty front, but he's got to be, you know, I would imagine. But his consistency. Started it, you know, right away as a 2-year-old. He actually only tried two turns twice in the Breeders' Cup Juvenile at Churchill, as a 2-year-old, and then Todd sent him to Charlestown to do the 3-turner in the Classic, and he was third actually there. And of course, Todd had success. Todd had been. Has been successful identifying horses to go to Charlestown for, you know, Caixa Electronica and that ilk, and there's been others, but
other than that, they kind of
6, 7 in a mile,
right? They kind of kept him in his little box there, and why not? There was plenty of races around, and like I said, I bet he raced at least 7, 8 tracks as well.
He actually, you know, when I say 2 turns, he also two-turned the Salvatore Mile.
It's a two-turner.
Two-turner, and
but it's a mile.
But it's a mile, and he won the Parks. He won the Parks Dirt Mile too, actually. Last on the undercard of
he beat a nice horse in there. I think one of the Asmussen horse.
Silver State.
Yes,
and Warrior's Charge.
Yeah. So and once again, probably
that was actually his career. He, you know, what's interesting about this comes up, and I'll have to ask Todd. His career best fig. In terms of buyers, a 104, and he did it twice, and he did it in those 2-turn miles. Excuse me. He did it in the Salvatore and in the Parks Dirt Mile, where his 2 best figs, which you wouldn't, I mean, given all the 6 and 7 and 1-turn mile efforts, like the, he got 100 in the Cigar Mile. That's kind of, you know, it's funny with all those wins and all that earnings. Only had 4 triple-digit buyers in his career.
That's amazing.
It is. He's
beaten some good horses all through those years.
Yeah.
You'd think.
A lot of high 90s. 97, 99, 99, 97.
And look at him. He's the kind of horse that he didn't win by 5-6 lengths. He won by a neck, nose, head, half. So he kind of just did what he had to do. He didn't have those run through the TV type performances. He was just a battle tough. Tested horse, and if it came down to it, his head was going to be in front.
It's true. And a lot of nose. In fact, you say that, won the Hopeful by 3/4. He actually won the Jerome by a mile, by a length and a half. Won the Bayshore by a length and a quarter. A nose in the Jerkins over Hog Creek Hustle. Oh my God, forgot about him. Won the Toboggan by a nose over Nicodemus. Oh my, another horse time has forgotten. Tom Fool, he won by a mile, length and a quarter. How about head wins in the Nayroot over Firenze Fire, and the head win over Silver State, head win over Hot Rod Charlie in the Salvatore, and the head win over Get Her Number Saturday in the Cigar Mile to finish his career. Just a really, really nice career.
So what's he up to? Where does he... Where's he go?
They're going to announce. I think I heard and read somewhere in New York. That he was going to stand somewhere in New York.
Why not?
If I'm not mistaken. So that was Mind Control. I'll put up. You know what I'll do? Let me take a couple of screen caps of both of these because they're just fun to appreciate. Not to belabor the topic about retirements, because it gets plenty of conversation. But here's two horses that were around for five full seasons. In the Philly, we talk about the fillies and mares frequently about. About how they don't have to be rushed off to stud as quickly. And Mind Control probably fits that description too, to some degree. As a son of State Thursday, wasn't going to necessarily be out of a lightning and thunder mare. It's a Red Oak, Brunetti homebred. There wasn't necessarily a early clamoring for his services as a stallion, but he certainly, has built the kind of resume that deserves a chance.
Well, sure he does. I mean, just from his guttiness alone, we just talked about it. I just wish these horses would stick around a little bit longer. Next year, what do we have next year? And it's an entirely different subject. I don't want to go down that rabbit hole too far, but 8 horses ran in the Classic, and we're going to have, 2 left? That are going to be around next year. We can do this another day, but it just hits me when we see these horses race to 5 and 6 and continue to run well.
Well, arguably, you could say that Mind Control, considering that all 4 of those triple-digit figs, you could make the argument that he didn't get to his best level until 5 and 6. And we've had this most notably, this conversation I've had with Shug McGee most often about, letting and having, part of it is having a horse, having enough horse to allow them to reach their full potential. And, the wear and tear, I mean, they This came up fairly recently with some with a trainer visit, and I'm going to draw a blank on who it was. But it horses, they wear down. I mean, we talk about mileage on the tires, and so having a horse that is physically capable still of reaching potential. Is part of the challenge, undoubtedly. Well, that was a big part. Those 2 grade ones. The 3rd grade one, we expect to talk to Graham Motion later, as soon as we as soon as we hear back from Graham, Graham Motion with those invaders that he sent out to Del Mar for the Hollywood Derby. And it was actually Speaking Scout that was the one. And Speaking Scout for Eclipse. So the... Yeah.
You mentioned Shug. He sent...
Well, he didn't break.
Celestial City out
didn't
there.
Didn't break, and then that was Ramon Vasquez really did not, I don't think, distinguished himself in his first ride with for Shug. But you know, the win from Speaking Scout, and this is a horse that, you know, was a square price.
Square price. He was, we talked about him on the show on Friday. He was 16-1 earlier, in the, like, you know, with 8 to 10 minutes to go. And I remember going, "Oh my gosh, this is wonderful!" And he ended up going off at 8-1, but paid a nice price. We talked about Wit, and I think just about everyone had the same feeling about Wit, that worth a try, definitely. But the mile and eighth might have just not been there for him.
The horse, of course, that I think some people probably had fun with and may have cashed tickets with was that maiden of Mark Glatz, that spy catcher who did exactly what Brad Free kind of expected him to do and anticipated that he might do, and ends up getting now he's grade one placed while he awaits. A maiden breaker, and he was the thing that was amazing is that he was the third longest shot on the board at just under 34-1. That was nuts, and got beat less than a length. Wit, the funny thing about Wit was the way Pratt rode him. He got beat less than a length, and it's not as if. It's not as if he was closely attending pace and got tired. He basically was sitting and came with a run and fell short. In the meantime, Speaking Scout and Hernandez, essentially passed, virtually all of them. Celestial City was languishing at the back. And Speaking Scout and... we talk so often about Eclipse, and then when Aaron Wellman joins us, he talks about their philosophy. They're a filly and mare operation, but here's a grade one winning male for them. Speaking Scout, this is a Mr. Speaker that Mike Abraham bred, and might be, this horse, if Abraham had kept, probably would have been in the hands of Bill Mott. Or I think Asmussen too, right? Mike Abraham.
I believe you're right. Now here's another one. If you look at his past performances, he's made the rounds. He's been all over the place, and I see a blurb that he's going to stay in California for the winter, and maybe Graham. When we get Graham on, we can ask him. Maybe he's going to have a small little string out there again. He's done well, and we've seen what the Eastern horses have done out there when they ship, especially on the turf. They've done very well. And you mentioned Hernandez, who earlier in the day with that Stormy Liberal race, the 5/8 turf race, he made just a super ride on that Phil D'Amato horse, Turn on the Jets, Hug the Rail, boom.
Turn on the Jets was like a universal, virtually all of us picked Turn on the Jets. And I was on the plane, and the... My second leg to get to Arizona, and I had 4 hours, and the internet was not, less than spotty, so I was having trouble getting any kind of results, and so I resorted to sending texts to people. The text is working, and that was all I could do, and so I was getting results, and when I think Chuck actually sent me Turn on the Jets, I laughed out loud because we all,
he was carrying a lot of weight.
Big time.
That was a super ride, just hugged the rail and got through and, won for fun for his first stake win. So that was But the, you know, the racing ended up real good at Del Mar. They ended up with a good meet. I know the field size was around 8, and here comes Pratt back in for the meet. Spends a few weeks and ends up winning the jocks title.
Well, we should include the other results, particularly the 2-year-old mile races, since we're doing the West Coast. Turn on the Jets, D'Amato with Juan Hernandez, and of course Hernandez riding for Grand Motion in the Hollywood Derby. The other three stakes all garnered by Flavien Prat. Regal Glory, of course, but the two-year-olds start with Liguria, and it's funny. Here, this was a win for Chad, and in my write-up, I said, the horse is okay. I'm not falling over myself to bet Liguria, and I suppose at some point, you just say to yourself, if Chad's sending this horse here, he anticipates that. He's going to be good enough, and he was. The coming off the maiden win was Liguria to become a stake winner. This is Alpha Delta. They paid $275,000 for this Warfront Son that was bred by Tada Nobutaka and was a Keeneland yearling. So Liguria and Pratt, and then yesterday, I guess along the lines of, believe your eyes or just go along logically. Brad Free actually said about Speedboat Beach, he said, I'm just going to have to trust that Baffert is committing this horse to the grass and just believes that he's a grass horse. And Speedboat Beach yesterday in the Cecil B. DeMille, the stretches out and had
to do a little battle in the stretch and did, we went to the handicapping 101 when we talked on Friday about these. I mean, you just start with looking at Phil D'Amato and looking at Flavien Prat. I mean, as a default, but this horse, he ran through the TV, ran a 104 on the dirt as a 2-year-old, yep. And whether it's just like, with the Pegram, Watson, and Whiteman crew, we've got plenty on the dirt. Let's move him to the turf. And he goes ahead and wins the little 5/8 turf sprint out there at the fall meet, the Speakeasy. And there's a little story, if you talk to Bob about this horse at some point, there's a little story that came out of the Breeders' Cup that he had a little problem with something that wasn't his fault during the race, and I'm not going to say it because I can't verify it, but that he was going to run very well here. You could draw a line through that race, and Bob on the stretch out is what, 0.31, which is not bad. Doesn't say dirt or turf, so.
That's true. Sprinter out, period.
Obviously he's done that his whole career. But he was well meant yesterday.
Basically dueled with the early leader, which was Game Time. And Game Time, the Sadler, Hieronis, Not This Time colt. And interestingly, another horse that on paper looked like, not absolutely locked in as a dirt horse, but it only took one start for Sadler to make the move to put him on the grass, and breaks his maiden. Game Time did in his second start on the turf. Interestingly, fourth different rider for Game Time, but this was a very good effort at a square price, 9-1. That first piece had to settle for third, and I didn't notice. Did he break poorly? Because he had been on the lead in the two turf starts for Glatt, and Mark had brought him up the other day when he joined us. This the Rancho Temescal, $75,000 fantastic colt, and he ended up sort of mid pack early, and I'm going to watch it again and see if he had a little bit of a tangled beginning.
I didn't
notice.
We were in the sports book in town here looking at football at the time, and had the had the races on the phone, so
good job.
Didn't catch a lot of them, but as we were going back and forth, so I actually had to go back and watch the replay of this one. So I was, but I didn't keep an eye on first piece. But look for Speedboat. I would imagine that he's going to stay on the turf and try and pick off some of those down the hillers. He might be a perfect down the hill type horse.
I know we don't think of Baffert with grass horses. He did have that nice 3-year old, right? That like two seasons ago. I think Jill, right? That Jill owned.
Yeah, and he had one. He had one. I'm going to say 20 years ago.
That's not going to contribute. That's not going to contribute to his thoughts as a turf trainer.
I think he had it was a year he won all the grade ones at Del Mar, and he won like the Eddie Reed, I think, with this horse. I can't think of the name of it. I'll come up with it eventually. Well, we can look it up, but I'll look up the Eddie Reed. But no, you do not think of Bob as, it's kind of along the line with Steve Asmussen. He runs horses on the turf. You just don't think that way. Whereas Todd now has kind of seemed to expand it a little bit more and, does have has a lot more turf horses in his barn than he used to. But no, Bob and Steve aren't really known for it.
Was it DuJour? DuJour was the won the American turf at Churchill.
Oh, okay.
It was a Temple City, and that Jill and Debbie Lanny, Donato bought this one. And in fact, speaking of people that we're going to see at the symposium, this was a horse consigned by Joe Applebaum and Off the Hook. Originally, interesting that it was actually a very nice pin hook for Joe Applebaum. Interesting. All right, there's a little turf aside. We didn't expect the yesterday did not know what to expect from this horse. I was sort of just. I was going to kind of take a. I didn't put together any play for the. Were you guys playing the force out pick six?
No, which was odd. It was just a sports bar. They didn't have.
They didn't have racing. Okay. Okay.
And because I looked when I got off the plane, I knew before I got off the plane that I was going to the sports bar, but got there a little corner there. I met a friend of mine there. And there's a little quarter, and they had the football on, and walked up, and I said, "Do you have racing here?" She said, "Is there racing now?" I said, "Okay, I guess they don't have racing.
They're racing now."
But there are a couple places around town that just have racing and don't have football, and there's some that have football and don't have racing. Joe Who was the name of that horse.
Oh, yeah.
That won the Eddie Reed.
He's talked about that horse with me. In fact,
back in 1999. Actually, he won the Firecracker before that. But so I remember, I think if you go back and look at 1999, was the year that he won all the Grade Ones at Del Mar. For some reason, that crazy thing.
Speaking of Grade
went
Ones,
into my head.
I did see the note in Steve Anderson's piece recapping Regal Glory's win. Chad that's his 19th, I think it was, and takes a. A one stake lead over, the Matriarch was Brown's 18th Grade One of the year in North America, one more than top rival Todd Pletcher with 17. And, of course, there's only...
I'm trying to think, not too many left.
There's the Malibu and the La Brea. And the
American Oaks might be American Oaks. Might be on opening day now.
Oh,
well.
Okay, and so there's perhaps three more opportunities. And Chad, you would think that Chad Brown's certainly a candidate to have somebody for the American Oaks.
Well, sure, and Todd as well.
A couple of other, and we're going to talk to Danny Gargan, so I won't talk too much about WNL. The Good Magic, and it was another terrific weekend for Hill and Dale with the win in the Demoiselle from Julia Shining, kind of a miraculous win. And the girls, tell you, there is a unusual circumstance. Again, it seems like 2 years in a row, the boys, usually the girls at the beginning, you know, of careers, 2-year-olds, usually the girls are faster than the boys. Right now.
You talking about horses?
Yeah, right now.
Or are you talking about people?
Well, the boys,
just kidding.
The boys are so much faster right now than the girls. It's pretty remarkable. I mean, the Figs and the Times of the two the 2 9 furlong events, WNL a 90 buyer, Julia Shining a 70, and we'll talk to Danny Gargan about it. It's a nice win. Danny's been a little quiet, and so that's a nice end of the year win in the Remsen, the good Magic Sun, and that really goes a long way to having. Yeah, absolutely. Get Keith to come sit down when you get him second. Come sit down.
All right.
There he is.
All the stars are here. And one of our speakers
way.
In our and the racing secretary conference I was talking about just sat down here from the esteemed state of New York.
Keith.
Naira Racing Secretary, Keith Toshel.
Hey, Steve, how are you?
I'm terrific, and this is one of those entertaining moments when it comes to students / alumnus of the University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program, because your first visit on the show came as a student.
Yeah, it's a little full circle, and I'm thankful to have Rick have me on a panel of racing secretaries from across the country later on this afternoon, and it's fun to be back here as someone who was now making a living in the racing industry when really not that many years ago, there were many of us that were going to school here that were looking to be involved, and you know, to come back is a pretty cool deal.
How many times have you come back for since you graduated?
This is my second one since graduation. I was here last year.
Take us back a little bit, and you know, there's certainly people listening that heard you as a student, and remind everybody about your origin story and what you know what got you here to begin with, and what your thought process was about coming to the University of Arizona and getting involved in racing.
Well, I started as a fan, as I think a lot of the students in our program did, although I didn't have any background in it from a family perspective. So racing has kind of become a second career for me. I spent 9+ years working in the golf industry, and never finished, completed my 4-year degree. I had a 2-year associate's degree, was working full time, had you know, moved out, had a little bit of independence, and thought that was a pretty good deal in your early 20s, not really kind of playing the long game and thinking to yourself, well, at some point in time, you know, having a college degree is important and really doing what you really want to do, you know, career wise is important. So at some point in time, you know, I kind of realized that golf maybe wasn't a lifetime career, and my wife and I weren't married at the time, but we were dating, and I think she kind of wanted to know how serious things were going with us and asked me what I really wanted to do, and I told her I really wanted to work in horse racing, and red flags probably should have gone up.
Well, you could have stuck around in this Saudi Arabia thing. You could have been a gold mine over there.
So we, you know, I told her about the racetrack program in Arizona and told her this is something I was interested
where
in
were
doing.
Where were you living at the
San
time?
San Jose, California.
San Jose. And
which is my hometown.
Interesting. How did you even hear about
the Pinehurst shirt on?
I think the first time I ever saw it was in a program ad in either the Daily Racing Forum or in a, you know, program, probably at Golden Gate Fields or at Bay Meadows. So that was kind of, I think, you know, the first time I ever really heard of it. And before long, I had reached out to Doug Reed, who's still running the program, and Wendy Davis, and kind of tried to formulate a plan to see if we could make this work. And you know, on a whim, we sort of on a whim. I mean, there was planning involved, but we moved to Tucson, and I spent a year at Pima Community College because I hadn't been in the classroom in 10 years.
Wow.
And transferred to Arizona, and we were here for 3 years in Tucson and actually really enjoyed our time in Tucson. And I was fortunate enough to get an internship from Rick at Santa Anita in 2016 and Martin Panza at NYRA in 2017, and was offered a job to start at NYRA December of 17. So it's been almost 5 years since graduation.
When you made the decision, what aspect of the game held your interest?
I think definitely the racing side of things. I really didn't know the type of jobs necessarily that were out there. I kind of had a general idea, but I wasn't the type to know exactly what different jobs, in particular on the front side, there were. And it was probably one of the first couple of days at Santa Anita, being in the racing office, I was like, this is what I want to do. Like, I wasn't really sure what I wanted to do, and then I was in the racing office, and the phones were ringing, or
And the music was playing.
Yeah, yeah. And they're, you know, putting a car together. I'm like, this is, you know, because I think the common misperception from people who have no idea of racing is like, oh, the horses just show up, and like, how does it really happen, right? And so the classes, you know, the class at Arizona kind of taught us, okay, well, this is how it gets done. But until you really see it from a practical standpoint and see it, you know, in front of yourself, you're kind of like, okay, like I sort of have a general idea, and then it's like, boom. And so it was kind of almost like an epiphany. I left there, I'm like, this is what I want to do. I wasn't sure exactly what part of, you know, the racing office administration I want to do, but I was like, now this is
for me.
Yeah, exactly.
So we mentioned half hour ago about the biggest thing in the program is the internships, where you literally get to go out and, you know, you're on the front lines. You're not sitting in a booth in the back. You're, you know, we put you to work. And that's the same thing happened to me. I didn't know, how does this stuff work? You know, the guys over there putting stuff in the program, and the guys over here doing this. It's like, oh, that's how it works. It doesn't just happen. And so same thing happened to you. You walk in and you go, wow, this is kind of cool.
Yeah, without a doubt. And it was fun this summer. We had an intern from Arizona, Eric DeCoster, who's a very, very sharp young man. And by the time Saratoga rolled around, he was assisting our paddock judge as an intern, just making sure horses were on the ring on time, getting riders up, and just, you know, it's stuff that regular college students don't oftentimes get to do during an internship. He's calling riders up for a grade one right before he leaves, you know, which is a really cool deal. And but not just that, I mean, he was there in the morning, you know, hustling races or working on reports or projects or, you know, anything like that that needed to get done, proofing condition books or stakes schedules. So, you know, much in the same way that you know, Rick tried to get, you know, get me involved in stuff at Santa Anita or when I first got to NYRA, you know, it's just kind of cool to be able to do that for a student in the program currently. And it was a great experience, and it really did help solidify what I wanted to do in racing.
You know, one part of this conversation, and, you know, for you, and of course you have a counterpart as an alumnus at NYRA in Joe Longo, who had a very similar career path. He was a certified public accountant and decided at 30 or 32 that he wasn't going to spend, you know, the next 30 years, you know, punching the abacus, and did the exact same thing, convinced his wife, I want to go here, I want to do this, and, you know, here he is, you know, one of the leading, you know, coordinators of signal management in the game, running the, you know, that department at NYRA.
Yeah, I think Joe and I maybe did the radio show at the same time on the same day, you know, back in whatever it was, in 16 or 17 with you. But, I mean, to be 100% honest, if I didn't have my wife's support, I'm not sure that this would have ever happened. So I was very thankful for it. But it was a great opportunity for me to find something that I really wanted to do career-wise. And, you know, it ended up working out well for myself as well as for Joe. And, I mean, we could reference, you know, other people in there. And I think that was the one thing that was the highlight of coming to school in Arizona. It's intimidating when you're going back to school and you're...
Sure.
You know, and I was 30 years old, I think, when I joined the program.
And I came back, I wasn't quite 30, but I was 24-ish when I came back to school. And it helped. Well, me, it helped. I'm like, this is great. I've already had this run through. I know you know, I mean, as far as
well, it's like a lot of professionals go back for masters. They'll go and work for 5 years, and about 26, 27, go get the that was the old school way to do it. But it has, you know, apparently Steve May, another guy that completely changed careers at 30.
If you're going back, you're probably serious that time. I mean, the first 5 years of my college, I wasn't too serious. You know, as I told my daughter after she finished her first year of college in 1 year, I said, Linda, you finished your first year of college in 1 year. That's great. She goes, what's the big deal? I said, well, your mom and I took like 3 or 4 years to get through that first year. But when you go back, you're more serious. And this is a profession that can be super hard on relationships. I mean, let's face it. If you don't have a wife that kind of gets what you're into, and you got to go here, you got long hours, you're traveling, you're doing all kinds of stuff. And it's like, I don't have time to do anything bad. You know, you're too busy. But if you don't have that with behind you, it makes things a lot worse. And so, you know, I have Gina, and you have your wife, and we got the Derby Barbie behind you here.
That's true.
Stephen. But
true.
And they have to support you, or it's miserable. We've all seen, we all have friends. We've all seen, you know, things fall apart, and for no reason. That it's just a tough go. We work every weekend. What are you doing that weekend? I'm working. You know, so
that's a good point.
And to Rick's point too, going back to school at a more advanced age, it is a little bit different when it's maybe your name on the student loans, and it's you're the one paying for your college education.
Yep.
You know,
whereas
maybe when you're fresh out of high school, you have, you know, parents' help, parents' support, and not that my parents weren't necessarily supportive of me wanting to do this. I was at the stage of my life where, you know, everything was, whatever I was doing, it was on me. So that extra semester of college, when you're looking at it like, oh, do I spend the extra? It's like, no, I'm looking to get in, get out, because every semester you were there, it was, you know, it could have been additional money that you're taking out, either student loans for, or that you're on the hook for. So I do think going back, there was a level of maturity that it was like, okay, this is like a job. I worked a job for 9 or 10 years. College is a job to get me where I want to go.
Right. You weren't going for a degree. You were going for a job.
I mean, I came back here to get a job in racing.
Yeah.
Getting the degree was, you know, an added benefit.
Right.
But without a doubt, like, I treated it like a job, as I know Joe does. I mean, I think most of the students here, I mean, we love racing. We're serious about it. If you want to work in racing, I think it was important to be here. Take your studies seriously. Take every opportunity, take advantage of opportunities to meet people and internships and the whole deal, and I found that if you do that, you could get where you wanted to go.
Address, because I know that there's plenty of parents listening that over the years that we've been doing this and coming out here, and even before I started coming out to do the show for these 3 days, there were visits about the program that Steve May literally found out about RTIP listening to the show, and there's others, Keith Stafford, parents that, you know, discovered this, and when their children had brought up the topic of maybe doing something in racing, they said, well, there's a program at University of Arizona. But talk about the back end of this, which is, okay, the internship with Hammer at Santa Anita, but the interview process and the decision-making process, because, you know, not only the respective spouses have to, you know, be supportive, but there's the potential for a complete upheaval in terms of where you end up living. I mean, you guys are from Northern Cal, and, you know, you're on Long Island now. I mean, and how, you know, those decisions get made. Talk a little bit about the process, because those that are listening that say, you know, what guarantees a job for my son or daughter, you know, in the industry?
I don't know that there's necessarily a guarantee.
Right.
But with that said, I think that if a prospective student or a current student takes advantage of the opportunities given to them, I do think there's a certain level of credibility. Oh, you went to the racetrack program in Arizona. Excuse me. You know, you're going to have a depth of knowledge that the average person who might be applying for a job that maybe likes racing, maybe thinks they know, you know, racing, but doesn't really know the ins and outs of it. And when you combine the classroom education with you know, the opportunities that, that, you know, could present themselves via jobs, internships, interviews, getting to know people, getting to know the different types of jobs in the industry. I think it is an inherent advantage and could be like a tiebreaker, you know, or could put somebody definitely in the driver's seat for a job, almost really no matter what kind of position they might want in racing. I just think, yeah, there's a level of credibility in the fact that, that folks like Phil O'Hara now and Robert Hartman and before that Liz Bracken when Liz was here, who was a huge mentor to, you mentioned myself, Joe, Kevin Schnoor, who's a, an alum who's here. But, you know, people that, that know people in the industry, I think, you know, if you can display, you know, display a level of quality to those folks, they're going to go to bat for you, and I think it's very important. I mean, the one thing I tell people when I meet them is when I first came here, I thought racing, oh, it's this huge global enterprise, and it is. I mean, you know, there's
just look around, Sky Racing from Australasia, you know, the bet makers. And
global
the,
tote.
So many.
But, you know, with that said, I mean, there's people that know people in this industry. I mean, connections are so important and getting to know people. You know, you might think, okay, the racing's so big, but then you start to realize, okay, everybody's connected in their own way. So it's very important to make those connections and learn from as many people as you can.
Well, especially for us who came from the outside.
Right.
You know, you have to develop a level of respect because you're not, you know, we didn't grow up racetrackers. I didn't grow up a racetracker. And it makes you work a little bit harder to get those relationships going, and so I don't know. I think it was maybe you could turn it to an advantage. And you mentioned the job situation. Well, there's no guarantee in anything, but if you have confidence, and in I don't know other industries, but in this industry, you get labeled quick, and you know. Good and bad, mostly, you know, good, but people understand, hey, that guy's a good worker. So if you're a good worker in this game, it doesn't, you know, when you go to apply for a job, I always say, here's the job interview. Keith who? Okay. Somebody calls, how's Keith? And you go, and you, as things go through your head, you go, if I give this guy a bad, if I say no to my friend on the phone, like, yeah, you don't want to hire him, he's not hiring him. So, you know, Keith, oh, yeah, he's great. Yeah, he was here for a couple. He was here for 2 years. Oh, he's fantastic. You know, Jimmy. Oh, yeah, Jimmy's great. So, once you develop yourself as a worker in this game, you're gonna have a job in this game. It might be at different racetracks around, but you're gonna have a job, and because you really have to prove yourself. There's no phoniness here. I mean, everybody knows everything about you here. So, you know, put your time into your work, and you're gonna have a job.
Keith Doschel's with us, racing secretary at the New York Racing Association, and let's talk a little industry, you know, news and views. What do people want me to ask about? I talk about stakes coordination, Keith, and what the answer is to fuller, more competitive stakes fields, not just in New York but everywhere, and the challenge that you face on, you know, really it's year long too. It's not end of the year. I mean, we had some things work against the Cigar Mile on Saturday. I mean, the Baby Yoda takes sick. The situation at Churchill with the EHV1 that kept Obesos from competing. So some things worked against it, but and got retirees. I mean, it's post Breeders' Cup, so there's certain things at different times of the year. But what I mean, when you're sitting down, when you're having the racing secretaries meeting, when you guys get together, what are some solutions? Are there solutions?
I think there's solutions. I mean, I think Rick's a perfect person to be on this conversation with, being that he's a member of the Great Stakes Committee for a long time. I think, first of all, from an opinion perspective, and I think there's just too many Great Stakes in this country, and the number of Great Stakes in this country has not decreased with the full crop decreasing, with early retirees with horses not staying on the racetrack. Now, that might, you know, I know that's maybe not a popular opinion, especially amongst owners and breeders, which, Steve, you are one. You know, it's a very difficult game to make money in, and certainly opportunities for people to have their you know, mares have residual value, or colts if they're trying to make stallions is very important. But with that said, we run a similar number of graded stakes that we did when the full crop was 33,000, and it hasn't really decreased similarly. So I think if there were fewer opportunities, just based on that, you would, for lack of a better word, force some of these better horses to compete with one another. And then I think coordination of stake schedules, it's something that we'll talk about as racing secretaries or as directors of racing, or I'll get emails. Oh, it'd be great to, like, you know, tweak our schedules so they fit a little bit better. But, you know, for the most part, most track operators are looking after their program first, or they might not want to make the concessions necessary for track A. They might not want to make the concession, so track B can make a similar concession. So I think that's part of, you know, that's certainly part of it too. Look, we see it acutely. One of the, in New York, we were at the forefront, for better or for worse, from a filling standpoint of stakes, where all stakes are non-Lasix. Well, if you have a horse that's run on Lasix his entire career, well, now you have the listed stake in New York for $100,000, even $125,000 in the wintertime at Aqueduct. Well, if Laurel's got the same race or similar race 2 weeks later that they can run on Lasix, even if the purse money's equal or close to equal, we'd have trainers, and especially in the infancy of it. Now that a lot of horses have run off Lasix in certain jurisdictions and haven't had maybe the negative effects on their performance, it's been less of a disadvantage. But certainly that is, I think, compounded things at least a little bit, maybe more so the last two years ago than now. But it's certainly a challenge. I mean, it's something that I think we as an industry should address, because you want to see the best horses face off against, you know, one another as often as possible. And right now that's not necessarily happening.
Keith said something that's basic math. 25 years ago, we had 35,000 foals. We had X amount of stake, graded stakes. Today, we have 20,000 foals, and we basically have the same number of graded stakes. So I have the graded stakes committee next week. I have a bunch of speeches in my head that I'm going to go there, and I'm going to not talk too much about it right now because it's right at that time, and I don't want to. I got a lot of thoughts. We can talk about it after the meeting a little bit more, but a lot of what you said is true. I think there could be a reduction in stakes. It's just a supply of, you know, supply and demand. I mean, it's not a, if there's too many opportunities for these races, they're just going to wait for the best one. There's one next week. There's one next, you know, if we didn't have that, broadly, one thing we are not talking about in our conference today is this, because that's a separate issue as far as sitting down and doing that. The only way, as far as I'll go, because you get me getting worked up already, but as far as I'm concerned, one way to get this thing done is to get seven or eight people, go to the Greenbrier, shut the doors for two or three days, literally, and come out there and say, okay, here's your race. You have to run it between weekend, 22nd and 23rd weekend. Here's your race. You got to blah, 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 blah. And basically set a schedule for the major races and then say that's it. Anyway, I'm not going to go any
further.
Well,
without indicting a specific component of industry management. And I mean, TOBA manages the graded state committee, right? I mean, it's under the TOBA umbrella.
It is.
Here's the question. I mean, whenever this comes up, one of the things that we seem to hear is the breeders don't want less graded stakes and less black type because it enhances the value of their production. And at the same time, though, wouldn't a trimming of the stakes opportunities, wouldn't it only make the stake performances that much more valuable, and therefore the product that much more valuable?
I'm gonna say this from, not because I am saying it because I am on the committee. Let me tell you what, this last 10 years of being on this committee is this group that's there is the most open minded, fair, non homey type of discussion people that I've been around in a long time, and the discussions that we have going in there or we listen to all angles when we're going over races, and I, you know, rarely do I see, you know, oh, geez, you know, I want every race to be graded. We go through things, and, you know, there's parameters that we look at. And so, yeah, I agree with you on one case, but it's fair. And like I said, I'm gonna hold off because you're getting me worked up because I the books came last week, meaning that all the books for all the divisions, and it's, you know, 400 or 500 races that you have to go through. And I'm, you know, I go through them and I make notes and I'm, you know, getting ready for next week. And, you know, we all have make our own arguments for certain categories and what should happen. And I'm there, and I don't want to, you know, get going here, but it's the fairest way to do it. It can't be done by a machine and spit out stuff, as there's certain circumstances where, you know, it rains and with the three favorites scratched the day before, so should they really be penalized for that a machine doesn't know, type of thing. What's going into races? We had the COVID year where some races exploded and some races were bad, so we just basically everybody, you know, we didn't make many changes that year. So there's the amount of time that the committee, the people on the committee, put into this, and the 2 days, full days that we go over these races, it's not done on a whim. Let's just put it that way.
No, I was fortunate enough to be a guest, an invited guest at the Graded Stakes Committee last year with our stakes coordinator, Andrew Burns, and it was a very eye-opening, you know, experience, and there were a lot of in-depth discussion about, you know, I think there's a lot of thought that goes into a race going from, you know, one grade to another grade. But with that said, I do think, you know, what you said about owners, breeders, and I don't even think track operators are on a mission either. I mean, it does sting when you lose a grade on a stake, especially if there's competition in that part of the calendar, or, okay, this is no longer grade two, it's now a grade three. Well, there's still a grade two in another jurisdiction that we might be competing with. It is going to be more of a challenge to fill that race because it did lose a grade, and maybe the purse gets decreased too. And now it's a double whammy. If you're saying, okay, well, we're not going to keep the same purse on a grade three that was a grade two, and you got one, like I said, just down the road, it definitely does sting a little bit. So I think track operators, I mean, we're trying, you know, we're in the business of trying to make our stakes as strong as possible. But when you do have something downgraded or have a prestigious race that, you know, it's maybe on a part of the calendar that maybe it could serve better being elsewhere, it's something that, you know, Rick's point is perfect. I mean, doing something like a pattern would be ideal. But if we're not going to do that, I think it's incumbent on tracks. And it's something that we in New York have certainly discussed is, okay, is this race getting lost in the shuffle of where it's at? Can we try to move it and still maintain its grade and make sure that it makes sense for not just NYRA, but, you know, for other participants? Like, where are these, if we're going to move a day, where are these horses going to come from? Which races could feed it, support it, and make it stronger?
And so what we run into is racing has so many different entities, and they run different times. Some racetracks run for a short amount of time, and they might have one big day. And so they want to put their day here, and then maybe it interrupts with a New York or a track that runs longer. You got Monmouth that runs, you know, Durham with Saratoga, and, you know, we had a Haskell Jim Dandy thing, you know, for years, you know, running next to each other, and now one's a two and one's a one. But there's so many different conflicts. It's not as easy as it's just, oh, let's just move this chess piece over here and this one over here and this one over here. There's just so many things go into it, and, you know, some, you know, tracks are rightfully selfish. You know, I want what's good for me. And somewhere down the line, there's going to have to be a little bit of a give, you know, back and forth to say, you know what, we'll sacrifice this weekend, you give us this weekend. Instead of having two mediocre races, we can have two good races, you know, a month apart. Things like that. And on paper, boy, it looks great. And then you go in the room and, you know, you listen to the, you know, track B's argument, and you're like, well, you know, they're right. And then another track argument, like, all right. So then we try and work out something in the medium, but it's not as easy. But you know, we're getting down to a smaller number of horses, and we got to make these races mean something,
Rick, because you have the you know, what is referred to as the horizon view. You've seen the long term ebb and flow. I got to ask, because I got to feel like one of the biggest impacts of all this are the, you know, the vicissitude of racetrack financing. And that specifically, in this conversation, the one and only Sal Sinatra, everybody, the advent of, I mean, we're going to Kentucky Downs every year now, and for instance, and Indiana, the way in which, I mean, horses follow money. If we can use the John Parada maxim, and you know the growth of, I don't want to call them pop up racetracks, because they most of them are, you know, have had ongoing success, but when you look at what has transpired at Kentucky Downs, and really the whole circuit with this explosive, you know, financial windfall, it tilts the seesaw, and this is something, you know, it in some cases it's gradual, and in some cases it's a godsend. I mean, what the fact that Indiana has been there, that Horseshoe Indiana is there to essentially replace Arlington, is invaluable to the industry, that there's a mid-American racetrack that can pick up that mantle. Canterbury, you know, kind of the entry mate during the summer season for Indiana. So the way in which, I mean, Ohio, look at what happened in Ohio. That looked like it was absolutely dead in the water. No to gaming, and then all of a sudden there was gaming, and overnight, you had a brand new racetrack in Mahoning Valley. You had a rebuilt River Downs, and a sustained Thistle. It's, you know, that part of, I don't want to call it an incursion, but it's a constant roller coaster in terms of horses being lured away. I mean, Mahoning has every right to run that distaff for $200,000, and it's pulling horses from somewhere, from some other, you know, long time standard on a calendar. So this is and no one seems to discuss this much. It's I know there's people that complain about the quote unquote slot assisted racetracks. But okay, it's a reality. So how do we find a happy balance?
It's just another fly in the ointment. I mean, that's why it's, the discussions are so deep now, because you have all this stuff. You got tracks with money. We have maiden races that are bigger than graded stakes, yeah. Purse wise.
Yeah.
Right, we ran maiden races. The purses were, I think, 120,000 at Kentucky, yeah. Downs, and then there's a Grade Three up the road. Purses 100.
Yep.
So there's got to be, you know, we're looking at some adjustment on that stuff. So, you know, the game is just constantly evolving, and so that's why, you know, there's going to be some long discussions in this session coming up, as far as things like that. But money doesn't necessarily buy you, you know, a grade. You have to,
but it does lure horses.
What I mean is, you can't just say, okay, we're gonna make a million. Okay, well then, it's an automatic get a grade. You have to earn your way.
Well, the grade is. I mean, the Kentucky Downs hasn't worried about moving from listed stake to Grade Three to Grade Two and Grade One. They just offered what they offered, and the natural, you know, the quality horses are going to come there. When you're offering $1 million at that time of year, it's the back half of the turf schedule for the last third of the year. Why, of course you're going to get the best horses.
Steifer has prestigious of a meet, and for as strong as our purse money is at Saratoga, and to Rick's point, we were riding $100,000 maiden races the last couple of years at Saratoga. I have had trainers, in particular Kentucky-based trainers, but maybe with a presence in Saratoga with stalls. You know, you might have a turf race second to last week or closing week, you know, going long on the turf. oh, well, you know what? I saw that race, but I'm going to wait for the race at Kentucky Downs. The purse money's higher. And you're thinking to yourself, it's a $100,000 maiden race that I'm telling you you're going to get in the race. Like, it might be a 9 or 10 horse field. And then you look at the overnight at Kentucky Downs, and you know, it's great for Kentucky Downs. You know, there might be 15 horses excluded out of the same race. And I'm calling a trainer saying, yeah, hey, we have 8 or 9 in the race. The race is going to go on closing Friday. Oh, no, the race is 2 weeks later, Kentucky Downs. We're going to point to that. And, you know, it shows the strength of you know, a place like Kentucky Downs. But when you have people passing up $100,000 maiden races, you know, in Saratoga, and that's the exception to the rule. It doesn't happen all the time, but it does happen where, you know, places like Boutique Meats have become such a place to run, in particular when you're running for, you know, for as good of money as we're running for up there. It's even, you know, even better at Kentucky Downs, you know.
Shouldn't that, and the corollary to that is, certainly for Naira, and as somebody that's breeding in New York and, you know, and has raced New York breds for the last 15 years, doesn't that help or reinforce your interest in carding New York bred races? And because if that group is going to head, you know, if that ilk is going to wait for Kentucky Downs, I mean, they're only eligible if they're part of the K, you know, the Kentucky Thoroughbred Development Fund,
right,
monies. I mean, if you've got a New York bred, a Maryland bred, a Jersey bred, whatever, you're not running for $130,000.
Correct.
So I mean, is that part of, I mean, look at what's going on right now, actually. For instance, down at Fairgrounds is relying on the Louisiana breds for the main track right now, because they're having to wait out their turf situation. So the state bred programs that for some reason people have this negative connotation, which I just don't get. It's an illogical bias against state bred programs, but does that make it easier for you to justify, you know, running more New York bred opportunities?
It does. I mean, and when I talked about, like I said, I'm talking mainly about Kentucky Downs, but if you look in the wintertime in particular at Aqueduct, the majority of the horses that run throughout the winter at Aqueduct are New York bred. It is over 50%. And truth be told, and we work closely with the New York thoroughbred breeders about options for, you know, stakes races and what we can do in tandem with them. I mean, they're a separate entity, but we work hand in hand with them as well as NYTHA, the New York Thoroughbred Horsemen's Association. I mean, the money has never been better in the New York bred program. And that's throughout the year. I mean, the purses may be higher during certain meets than others, but you're running in restricted state bred races, you know, first level allowances this time of year or for the next meet are $80,000. Maiden races, $75,000, and even higher, you know, up to $90,000-$95,000 for allowance races up in Saratoga. And, you know, we do rely on that program, and we really count on that program being strong and having enough, you know, New York bred foals to sustain, you know, not only a high level. And truth be told, there's some very high level New York breds that have come through that program that can compete in open races throughout the country. And, you know, it certainly that helps supplement, you know, having international presence, especially with our grass racing program where we try to get top international horses. We have a lot of top owners import horses from Europe. So having a strength there, having a strength with our state bred program, and then trying to get, you know, the top horses from throughout the country. I mean, it's a challenge, but it's something that, you know, we definitely try to focus on to create a strong program. But yeah, the state bred program in New York breds is very important. And, you know, I think maybe even more so with the increased purses from other jurisdictions, I mean, around us, you know, whether or not it's, you know, New Jersey or certainly Kentucky or Maryland's gone up with, you know, having additional supplemental purse money.
Virginia
is Virginia is a perfect case in point.
And they're going to be adding days,
right?
As things progress towards 50 racing days ultimately.
Yeah, Yeah.
And that'll be, and you know, in terms of a turf course, in terms of cards, you know, on a 9-race card, they're going to run 7 turf races at Colonial on a day, because they got like 6 turf courses worth of it's like 4 golf courses laid out there in the middle of that field.
Yeah, it's they have a lot of options as far as rail placements and gate placements, and it's we having 2 turf courses at Aqueduct now, it wasn't always the case certainly, but at Aqueduct, Belmont, and Saratoga, we were for a long time able to run more turf races than anybody else in the country. And with the rise of turf racing, I think in this country, and it gaining in popularity, it's certainly an advantage that we have that we try to take advantage of. But there are other places that are like, okay, you know what? Maybe we didn't run as many turf races or didn't, and now in order to compete and offer full fields, like you might be offering more turf than ever before. And certainly like Gulfstream's a perfect example where they ended up, renovating their turf course, and, now they have to compete as well. But, I think, they were also at the forefront of running a lot of turf racing on one turf course, and they had to, do the project that they did. And I talked to Mike Lakeau down there, and they were really excited about it. And we're hoping that it allows them to have, maintain a strong turf program in the winter or in the winter months. But, we run 5-6 turf races a day through most of the year, certainly at Saratoga and certainly at Belmont. And, it's something you have to do to compete with everybody else, because if there's a lot of options out there.
Well, and you mentioned the Gulfstream adding the all weather, Naira seemingly poised to do something very similar with the Belmont renovation, and the option, because long term the racing will be at Belmont, could be 8 years, could be 15 years, who knows when that all comes to pass, that Aqueduct goes away, but that is another option, and all that would do is provide continuity from the late fall, early winter to the spring, because the turf horses wouldn't have to ship out of New York. You could keep your turf horse at Belmont and run on a synthetic surface and at least get a few stars. Absolutely, you could.
You could.
Why wouldn't you?
Ask the turf trainers. They like to run on turf.
I mean,
you might get some that are left behind, but with Gulfstream putting in their course there, I mean, Santa Anita's even talking about maybe widening their course again, and I mean, they've already shifted to almost 50-50 turf in California the last couple years.
I mean, I have heard this, Steve, to your point, Steve, trainers of horses that are based in the Mid-Atlantic, at Fairhill, where they train over, or have the option to train over Tapeda.
Yep.
Horsemen at Woodbine, who race on a synthetic main track for their season, that maybe instead of, some go to South Florida, some turn their horse out for the winter, but I have had some of those trainers express interest. Oh, well, if this synthetic, track comes to fruition at Belmont, well, maybe, it would be something where some of the trainers from Canada would be interested in, just for the continuity of training over a similar surface. I mean, we're very excited. Our pony track at Belmont,
that's right,
opens tomorrow, or is scheduled to open tomorrow, and we just put a Tapeda course in there. So Glenn Kozak and his team have been working to get that ready. So it'll be not only another option for our trainers to use it. I mean, it was a popular place to gallop horses and to train in the first place when it was conventional dirt. But now that it's synthetic, it'll give our horsemen a different surface to train on, and it'll give us kind of a test case to see how it holds up throughout the winter and what, potential, Tapeda compensate, what formula might work best for, the environment in New York, in the cold winter months, and it could give us a little bit of insight in how to proceed if the synthetic, the fourth surface at Belmont ever comes to fruition.
Training, having that available to train on is a home run, and especially in the way that Tapeda is made now. It's not a one size fits all. with Michael and Joan, who they go out there and they, you know, your formula is not the same formula that would be in the Midwest, that would be in California. It's tailored to the
The composition of it's going to be different than what, you know, certainly what they're doing at Gulfstream and really anywhere else. You know, Golden Gate Field still has
Tequila. Exactly.
And, you know, Presque Isle has it, but they don't race in the wintertime. So it'll give Glenn and his team, in conjunction with working with Michael and Joan, and, you know, okay, well, what could work for the wintertime? And it'll give us an idea of you know, what a Tapeda surface would look like, maybe not under racing conditions, but at least under training conditions, you know, in December, January, you know, February, March, when we're, you know, dirt only, and even in April.
Look what it's done for Turfway Park. I mean, the state, there's horsemen there. Wesley Ward, you ask him, that's his favorite racetrack to train on, and he really runs
it. I mean, Wesley trains Breeders' Cup level horses there throughout the winter.
Absolutely. Loves it. And so, you know, there's a perfect example of them tailoring their formula to fit, you know, Northern Kentucky in the wintertime. And it's, you know, look at the racing.
Yeah.
I mean, with the purses, but still they're going there. So,
yeah.
With that, you know, you could create their own little Tapeda circuit quietly, look at a little underground circuit here in the States, right?
Yeah. No, you'd see Wesley horses that would go to run at Royal Ascot that they were training at Turfway throughout the wintertime, you know, and in some cases anyway, not exclusively, but in some cases that's where they were training. And so it's definitely something we're excited about, the, you know, the pony track. Hopefully we'll get positive feedback from our horsemen. And like I said, it might not simulate racing conditions, but it'll give them another option, another surface, and it'll give us a lot of insight. And Glenn Kozak does a tremendous job for us, and is, you know, he's one of the busiest people in racing, I think. But
if he wasn't called in to fly around the country in emergency circumstances at racetracks across the country, he could concentrate 100% in New York.
Yeah, he was out there on the pony track like last Friday, raking it as I was back there during training hours. I walk by and I see him with the rake, and he's like, "Yeah, we're trying to get this open in a couple of weeks." And
I love it.
You know, so that's something that we're excited about, and the whole Belmont renovation project, as I'm sure you've had Pat McKenna on, and you know,
Trains.
We talked about. It's an exciting project. We're hoping that, you know, we can have one of the most state of the art racing and really entertainment complexes. UBS Arena is a fabulous arena, and you know, we're looking forward to hopefully having a reimagined Belmont Park in the next 5 years. It could be, you know, one of the premier places to race and train in the country.
Keith Dolschel has been with us, and, of course, a University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program alumnus, and didn't take long for Keith to rise to the level of racing secretary at NYRA. And, Keith, delighted always for always happy and as you've matured into the roles, got to see it firsthand right from the origin here as a student. Continued success. I appreciate this.
Well, thanks for having me. And this was good timing, as I was walking in to get registered, and I saw Denise, and she says, "Oh, Rick's over there." So I'll go say hi to Rick, not knowing that he was doing your rate. But no, thanks for having me, Steve. And you know, I appreciate, you know, your support of the industry, certainly, and of New York racing. Like, you know, I know you're an owner, breeder, and somebody that enjoys racing in New York. So continued good luck with your racing
that.
And breeding operations as well. And but yeah, thanks for having me.
Keith Dolschel.
You can see Keith is part of the new wave, so to speak,
of
you know, younger, newer faces on the racing circuit. And seriously, you've done a great job. You can just tell by talking to him for the last 15, 20 minutes, New York's in good hands.
Oh, thanks, Rick. I appreciate that.
And you know, it's great to know that when you pick up the phone, you need something, or you're going to call someone who knows, he's going to have an answer for you.
Well, and you can follow Keith.
Oh. Of course.
You're not a big Twitter.
I'm not an
observer.
I am, yeah. I use it as a news source and less as a...
Look, when you do what he, you know, what he does and what I did for a long time, you're not big on, you don't need to be out there. You know, you find yourself, you just kind of tune it off. I've been a little more active lately because I've been able to. to be, but nah, you don't need to read that stuff. It's good or bad, you just don't. So you're just fine. You just, you know, have a few followers and do your own thing. You'll learn that because, you know, we actually were talking to someone at the bar last night about that, and it doesn't matter. They say, oh, it doesn't bother. Yeah, it does. You know, some goofball that's sitting in an armchair out in, you know, Reading, Pennsylvania, writes some stupid thing about you. You kind of go, it does. So you're better off just not even seeing it.
Yeah, I think to a large part, to echo Rick's point, I think, you know, I think most of us, I mean, nobody's a bigger critic than ourselves in this industry. And if there's a, you know, maybe a race or a card that we want to be a little bit stronger than it turned out to be, like, we know it, we feel it, we feel the, you know, we feel the excitement and pride when there's a super strong day of racing, and when there's a day that maybe we wish would be a little bit bigger, we feel, you know, that on the opposite end, we don't necessarily need to get that hammered home to us any more than you know.
We know, trust us.
Like, you know, we do, and you know, I think anybody that takes pride in their work, no matter what industry they're in, would tell you the same thing. Yeah. It's just a little bit more. You know, maybe a little bit more, you know, high profile when Rick was certainly at Santa Anita or in, you know, myself in New York. But, I'm out there. I read it, but I don't dwell on it. So probably the best way to put it.
Keith Doschel, everybody. Hammer with us, of course. Let's take our only break of the morning. We'll come back. We're going to check in with Rich Migliori. I want to get Rich's take on what transpired as well at the rest of Cigar Mile Day. Back after this, we're live at the University of Arizona Racetrack Industry Program. You can hear a few of the booths still being constructed and getting some registrants that are wandering through. And we're going to talk, I think, Rick, top of the... Robert Hartman at the top of the hour? Okay, Robert Hartman's going to join us at 11 Eastern. And let me get a picture of the two of you together. That's a good idea. All right. University of Arizona. It looks like the fog is finally burnt off. And hopefully we see some sun. I've been here 2 days. I haven't seen the sun yet. Back to Tucson right after this. Rich Migliori joins us.
The latest racing news. It's At the Races with Steve Bick on Sirius XM Radio.
Thoroughbred Horse Racing is back in Virginia as Colonial Downs conducts its More Racing, More Money summer season presented by Woodford Reserve. An early week racing schedule and average daily purses of $625,000. The 9-week meet runs from July 11th through September 7th with racing every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 1:45 p.m. Wager on Colonial's 50-cent pick 5 with a low 12% takeout and a new carryover provision. All races will be broadcast on TVG this summer. Colonial Downs racing Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday at 1:45 p.m.
Who are you betting on? How about an app created specifically for horse racing? Naira Bets. We specialize in thundering hooves, fist pumping, and boosting your bankroll with robust weekly promotions and offer betting tips from actual horse racing experts. Bet all day and night, nationwide. Get the action and thrill of horse racing with Naira Bets. $200 deposit match with promo Steve200. Visit NairaBets.com for details.
The Pons family's Country Life and Maryland Farms are the place for breeding and racing in the Mid-Atlantic. Country Life is nationally recognized for making stallions and currently stands the Mid-Atlantic's leading first and second crop sires, Divining Rod by Tappan and Mosler by Warfront, as well as Frisian Fire, Maryland's 5.